This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Poet Michael McPhee is known for creating rich images of his native Appalachia, images that are grounded in the simplicity of everyday life. In his new collection, We Were Once Here, the cast iron skillet, chewing tobacco, and linguistic peculiarities of the mountains become anchors for stories woven in memories. Michael McPhee reads from his new book next Thursday, February 16th at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. He is also a professor of English and creative writing program at the UNC Chapel Hill, and he joins me now in the studio. Always a pleasure, Michael. Welcome back. Good to have you
here. Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
This book really is in a way divided into three parts, is it not? Tell us about how you conceived this volume.
Well, I conceived it retrospectively in that these are the poems I happen to have written in the last 5 years. Yeah. But I think a lot of poets do that, looking back at their work and discover what they've been obsessed with. And I was obsessed, as you said, with having grown up in Appalachia and the characters and the culture and the speech, especially of the mountains. And then the middle section is a suite of poems based on the last days of my niece Stephanie, who came to live with my wife and me after she had a cancer diagnosis and was being treated at Duke. I had not really planned to write about that experience. I certainly hadn't planned to put it in a book. But once I converted it into words, which is what poets do with experience and how they deal with it, I realized it fit okay in this pattern this book was making.
Let's talk about that first section, the lovely language of Appalachia, which is still continues to hold you in thrall. Expressions, words like ambier and do-rot, I swan, they won't let go, will they?
They won't, and I keep that appetite for mountain language alive by reading in things like the Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English, which is a great, I've read cover to cover, it's great. There are all kinds of esoteric glossaries of Blue Ridge and Appalachian speech, and I just love to dig in those things, because what it reminds me is of things that my family would say that I'd forgotten for a while.
Well, maybe that brings us to your first poem, or the first one in the volume, I Swan.
I would be delighted to read it. And it is called I Swan. Instead of I swear, I declare, I vow, our mom would say I swan when mad or tickled, and sometimes even I swanny, that tiny uplift in the suffix adding another syllable of astonishment or utter disbelief. It may be that the phrase came from the Scots I swarrant ye, I will guarantee you, adopted as a euphemism for I swear, and used by Christians to avoid that verb as Jesus warned in the Sermon on the Mount, but I doubt that my come-to-town mother knew or cared about its etymology. She said I swanny because it was something her fearsome, beloved granny had said when stirred, a pithy subject-verb outburst that waited in Mom's mouth for decades until she could say it to her own cheeky kids. Reaching without thinking way back to a shady slope deep in Haywood County and digging up its potent forked root. We knew to be still when we heard I Swan. We hoped our tears would be tears of laughter.
Michael McPhee reading from his latest volume, We Were Once Here. He's going to be reading at Flyleaf Books on February 16th at 7 o'clock. Here with us now, you know, I talk about language all the time on the show. We talk about various kinds of vernaculars. And for the first time, I just had this insight reading your poem about the magic of language, the fact that it is so plastic, it changes so much, and yet it's meant to really communicate. So it's meant to be standard, and it's always conforming to local needs and local customs. And still we understand.
Right. They're local and they're also even familial. I think certain families use certain phrases, like my mom saying I swan, which, again, I hadn't thought about for decades. Then I read this book and they had this interesting definition of I swan. I thought, forget the definition. I can just remember how it hit my ear. It's like there's a poem later in the book about my mother, though she's not named in that poem, how she used to, when she was comforting me, she would say, there, there. There, there. And it's just the way that cadence of saying that is something that you never forget. It's in you forever.
But it's interesting when you go back, you say you do research and you look through these dictionaries and see these words. And I wonder what that's like for you to see the kind of cold definition of this thing, you know, in a volume of in a dictionary.
Oh, it's fun. Because I'm a word nerd, Frank. Yeah. I think you know that.
Yeah.
And I remember reading once that somebody said when Auden died, they found his Oxford English Dictionary basically clawed to pieces, which is, I think, what poets do because they just love words. So I'm delighted when I see them. And honestly, many of them don't mean anything to me because I didn't hear them. Or it seems like a more scholarly exercise in exhuming these words, but then others just really hit close to home.
But it is fascinating in the sense, I mean, would you say that your mother and others who used and adapted these words are poets in their own right?
I would, though. Of course, they would not say that about themselves.
Well, of course.
And I would say about growing up in the mountains, I never thought about myself as growing up as, say, an Appalachian American. It never would have occurred to me until I had some distance from it, and I realized, oh, I was raised in a kind of an interesting place, and there were these unusual and, you know, word-delicious things going on that I can now look back at.
Well, the sense of place comes through palpably in your poetry, and it always has and does again in this volume. But as you say, there are a couple of sections. The second section deals with the death of your niece, who you and your wife, as you say, took care of in her last days. Tell us more about the experience first, and then we'll talk about the poetry.
This is my late sister's daughter, Stephanie, whom we had helped raise earlier in her life but had been a little bit out of touch with. She phoned up one day and said that she had gotten an odd scan and needed to come up and be seen at Duke. And when I opened the door and saw her, I thought, oh, my, you really are sick. And we took her in because it's what you do with family. You take in and take care of her. And I really, as I said, had not planned to write about this. I wasn't experiencing this and thinking, oh, this is going to make a great poem. Far from it. But I think, Frank, it was just such an intense time for all of us, especially for Stephanie, that I felt like this might be the best way to pay tribute to her, and not because it was so unusual, really. I think so many families have gone through a thing very much like this, where a family member or a friend gets this dire diagnosis, and then what do you do with it?
Well, also, I mean, you say you hadn't expected to write about you. You hadn't expected to do it. I mean, well, if somebody comes to your door, I mean, what does that do to you? You know, again, sort of opening your lives. Nobody's expecting to now give palliative care.
No, but I think that's one thing you have to be willing to do, not just as a poet, but as a human being. Mm-hmm. You have to be open to this sort of surprise. And when something presents itself and needs to be tended to, you tend to it. And that's what we did. And the one thing I regret about the middle section of this book is I wrote it from my point of view, as if it was me and Stephanie doing all this. Of course, my wife was doing it as well. But I started writing the poems with the we point of view, and I realized I just needed two people rather than three.
That relationship. I wonder, well, maybe I should ask you to read one of the poems now, and then we'll talk more about this section of poetry. Michael McPhee.
This is a poem called Metastasis. It's after she had gotten her diagnosis of stage 4 lung cancer. And I just thought, metastasis is such a strange word. Where did it come from? So this is yet another word nerd poem that goes somewhere that I didn't expect it to go, which always makes me happy. Metastasis. First used in a medical sense to describe the metastasis of the morbific matter. Morbific, causing disease. That was in 1663. Most incorrigible and obstinate metastases. By the time we saw it, the adenocarcinoma had migrated to her spine, hence the backache, her adrenals, her brain. Beyond correction, incorrigible. Adhering stubbornly, obstinate. We can't cure you, but we can treat you, said the doctor when Stephanie asked him. Metastasis sounds like a kind of heaven, a state beyond stasis, a transcendent balance, though in her case it meant the opposite. This kind of cancer was once called terminal, though nobody uses that end word anymore.
Metastasis is a poem contained in Michael McPhee's latest volume, We Were Once There. He'll be reading it at Flyleaf Books. We've got that information at our website. You know what poets and writers often talk about, being open to surprise, allowing themselves to be open to the experience. I wonder if that's the same as, for you in this case, the kind of openness that the shocking surprise of having to take care of someone when you hadn't expected to answer that door. Is that the same feel? Does that come from the same place, that openness?
It is a similar experience, that kind of unexpected presentation, and in this case, a human presentation. But I think as a writer, you feel luckiest when you have, when you don't labor to get at something, but it surprises you, it takes you aback, and then what do you do with it? It's just sort of what I was thinking. What do I do with this experience of having taken care of Stephanie? And I think as writers, what we do is we turn it into words.
We do, but the reason I'm curious about
sure.
this for you is that one of the things we do with experience that's difficult is to try to convert it into something that isn't, either avoid it entirely or transform it using words, right? Using language to pretend it's not having the effect on us.
Sure, and there's a poem that I won't read here called Stars in Your Crown, which is about a woman I did not know, a stranger, who found out about the situation. She said to me, this is going to be stars in your crown in heaven. And that really made me mad, honestly, because I thought, no, it's not going to be if there are crowns in heaven, if there is a heaven. But of course, I also realized that she was trying to deal with something that's almost impossible to deal with, that's in a way beyond words. So what do you say? Often we say really empty or foolish things, but we're humans. It's the best we can do. We try.
But think about that. I really want to explore this a little more deeply. The way in which poetry and literature in general can be transforming and bring us to the center of our humanity, which often brings us to grief, and the way in which language can be used through propaganda, through, you know, sort of other kind of mirages to escape. I mean, there's a fundamental difference in effect, even though the tool language is the same.
Sure. And I think you feel lucky as a writer if you can tap into that that depth, that almost wordless depth. Many of us saw this after 9/11. How do you deal with an overwhelming unexpectedness like that, awful unexpectedness like that? It was interesting and touching and moving to me that so many people turned to poems. They were reading poems to each other and sharing poems as a way of trying to deal with it. And sometimes that's the best way to do it.
You talk a little bit about your anger at the kind of, I'll call it sweet talk, but this effort to sort of talk your way around it. Did that change for you? I mean, obviously, on the one hand, it's a way of just coping, you
sure.
know, one way of just coping. But it can also be destructive if we're not allowing ourselves to experience the fullness.
It can be, though. I have to admit, I realized that my niece, who was very brave in some ways, but also relied on, to a degree, a certain superficial reaction to this profound thing that was happening to her, that she needed to do that, and that I needed to respect her right to do that. It was her way of dealing with it. You know, when she was saying things happen for the best to her social worker, you know, I was thinking they really don't always happen for the best. But she needed to say that.
Yeah.
She needed to think it. She needed to feel it. It was a comfort to her. So fine. That's fine.
And you are famous for, and I think one of the best at, using the everyday words. And, of course, you know I'll never use quotidian here to describe everyday for the obvious reason. That everyday language where you talk about, you know, tobacco spit. And there's another poem here where you talk about the funeral and the particular matter of the end of death, the end of life. And so you use the very particular, very grounded words to take us far deeper.
Well, that's where poems start for me, Frank. I know poets work differently. Some work from ideas or things they want to say in their poems. That has never been an effective strategy for me. I almost always start with a thing, an image, an overheard phrase, a scrap of music, something really specific and sensory leads me into what it is I need to write about, which then, of course, then does take on meaning and larger expression, but it starts with that kind of focus.
So is it really for you that kind of process, write a timeline, oh, that's an interesting image, I'll go with that, and then you discover what you meant by that.
Right. And, you know, sometimes I start exploring it, and it doesn't go anywhere because I'm always carrying around this piece of paper in my pocket where I write down these phrases and these things I see. But if you're lucky on a good day, it does take you somewhere. And as I sort of mentioned earlier, it takes you somewhere you didn't expect.
Yeah.
Robert Frost said, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader.
Hmm.
He said, if you have a last line and you try to write a poem that leads up to it, it's going to be a terrible poem because the poem needs to be an act of discovery with any luck.
Yeah, and there's certain grace moments, and I think probably what happens in that case, maybe you can tell me, is that you begin to then construct. If you start writing to the end, you're going to leave out all the grace because you know how it needs to be built to get there, right? And then you're not going to allow for those little spaces that don't look like you'll ever arrive.
Yeah, I might not use the word know. I might use the word feel to get there, because honestly, when you're in the moment of composition, or the hours of composition, or I'll say when I'm in those hours, I'm not really thinking at all on the usual conscious level. When you get into this space that the poem starts to make, it's just you and the words on the page. And with any luck, if not every word, every line will open up some new direction or dimension that you hadn't planned. And with any luck, that will be a good direction. But of course, then you go back and revise it once you've got it on the page, and take out stuff that isn't working as well, or tease out stuff that needs to be teased out. And, you know, of these poems that are in this book, these are not all the poems I wrote in those 5 years. I would say this is probably a quarter of the poems I wrote during that time, but they're the ones that seem to get closest to what it is we're talking about.
Well, I'd like you to read another one for us, because that takes us right to Fats Waller. Will you read it?
I will. This is the last poem in the book. There are certain singer-songwriters, musicians that I love. And I've had in previous books poems about Ella Fitzgerald, Duke Ellington, but Fats Waller is probably my favorite. So this is a poem I wrote after reading several biographies of Fats and listening to his music for years. So it refers to some biographical data. It's called Fats Waller. Yeah, I yearn. Sure I do. Yeah, ad-libs Fats in the second verse of Supposin'. One of a million throwaway jokes he tossed off to mock some sappy, lovesick lyric with his popular, portly clown act. The eye-rolling, finger-wagging, and ass-shaking that hid how hard he'd had to work. How he learned to play by slowing down piano rolls and fingering the depressed keys. How years at the Lincoln Theater's organ sharpened his timing and sense of audience. How he took lessons practicing Bach inventions so he could play two strong hands, though his band said that he perfected his left just so he could hold in his right a glass brimful of gin. Yeah, he yearns, sure he does, who doesn't, for booze or food or lingering kisses after a long night of music. But his ear somehow transcribes our common yearnings into joy. He said, you got to hang on to the melody and never let it get boresome, and he never does. No matter what sort of a song Fats sits to play, he soon teases out its lively fun and makes us part of his party, ready to dance and laugh and have another drink, while the man in the beat-up derby keeps loving that old upright with nimble fingers.
Michael McPhee reading Fats Waller from his latest volume, We Were Once Here. What was it about Fats Waller's life? Certainly that stride piano changed forever music in America and was fundamental to what is now jazz.
I think it was that he was always having so much fun.
And by the way, he was
irrepressible. Yeah. And that his fun, it wasn't just silly. I think people look at the sort of act that he put on and think that he was sort of playing the fool. He was a really serious musician. He was a really good piano player. His songs, his best songs, are immortal. Yeah. They're just great. And I think that he could present all that with this joie de vivre. Is a model for any artist, I think, certainly for me.
Michael McPhee, always such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you, Frank.
Michael McPhee is a professor of English in the creative writing program at UNC Chapel Hill. His latest volume is called We Were Once Here, and he'll be reading at Flyleaf Books February 16th at 7 o'clock. We have that information at our website, stateofthings.org. There's more State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned.